I'm kind of a left to right guy. I'm wondering if we could start with rows and envelopes and when they began and why you set out making them.
Well, this is probably a composite fiction to say, but when I was a little boy, I saw a film, The Light That Failed, starring Ronald Coleman. But I noticed that he drew on the margins of his stationery when he was in the film, when he was a correspondent in North Africa. And it turned out my father was also stationed in North Africa at this time. In any case, I started drawing on what was called V-mail, and then on envelopes, and then from time to time, it just occurred to me that it was a delight. And eventually, I probably spent more time with dressing the envelope than with the message inside. So, sort of the message was the envelope. I thought what delighted me was worthwhile sending to someone else. That essentially was my aim.
Hey, when you said V-mail, was that for Victory Mail?
V-mail, V as in victory, yes. It had a particular size and conformed to a form that they were able to photocopy so that they could reduce the weight of the mails that were sent. So when I sent letters to my father in North Africa, they were... Of course, I sent a lot of drawings to him and so on. I didn't realize if he saved every one, but since they were reduced, they really looked pretty good for a kid that was 9 or 10 and 11.
Well, you branched off into art in so many different facets. I'm wondering whether the size of the envelope, just the restriction of that give you some sort of freedom in a sense.
Well, I would think of it as, limitations are no limitations. I used to give my students an assignment to place a stamp on an envelope where it is both large and small and tall and narrow and so on. There is an ideal place. I think that, painting began with the bricks in Babylon, the Ishtar Gate and so on, where an artist really had to think of the rectangle and... the envelope is essentially related to that gate. I mean, I just love the limits, and of course, there are ways of releasing certain energies on an envelope that one might not be able to find in writing a letter.
I'm wondering if you could give me an example of that, one of those moments where you reserve that sort of treatment to just that medium, that's something you couldn't get elsewhere.
The possibility of the stamp. Fortunately, my last 13 years, I had postmistresses who allowed me to put stamps wherever I wanted to. But, to begin with, where we were required to place a stamp in the upper right-hand corner or the lower left-hand corner, if you narrow the margin of the white when you place a stamp on it to the right of the stamp and you narrow the space on the upper part at the edge of the stamp, in one sense, you make the stamp wider, and you make the stamp taller and larger. And then if you look at the space to the left of that stamp, which goes all the way to the left margin of the envelope, of course, it's smaller. So it allows a release of opposites of the same kind. I mean, space is inescapable for an artist, I think.
Mm.
I mean, he may not or she may not use color, but space is always a distinct problem and opportunity, I'd say. In any case, there are many images that occur, even the handwriting and so on, playing with intervals, which, of course, you would be familiar with musicologically, and I play a lot with what intervals release. The greater distance is sometimes the closer distance in terms of what comes before and what comes after in the image. And then the whole access to our reading from left to right. For instance, I've noticed that if the handwriting goes upwardly from left to right, just in a slight slant, when one reads it, it has an upward quality to it. I look very carefully at envelopes I receive because it's some indication graphologically that whether a person may be up or down. But I think that the ascent from left to right is not reversible. And in many paintings, for instance, if you look at Cezanne's still lifes, you'll find that the table may begin lower down on the left and the back edge of it becomes higher on the right. And so there's sort of this progression, upwardly progression. And I feel it's sort of one of those visual secrets in Cezanne, why when we look at it, is it not a lonely vase or of flowers, or why is it not a basket of apples that tumble out and down, and yet the painting seems delightedly upward.
I've read calligraphers speak of, or those who study handwriting speak of the connection. You alluded to it earlier, that if you sign your signature in an upward motion, or typically write moving upward, that would lend itself to a more sunny disposition in a person. But you're extending that into art itself on a canvas.
Well, I would say visually. You know, one of the difficulties I have is the tendencies for so many people to sort of leap to meaning at the expense of the existence of the thing. So that I got a letter from my daughter saying, what are you saying in your painting? And, you know, I came back with the old, with the axiom, well, before it is a white horse and it's white paint. I think you have to think that meaning or existence with meaning is, without meaning is trivial, but meaning without existence is terrifying. I think that this tendency for an individual to, in his or her expectations, to just leap to meaning. In fact, I made a little, sent a little quatrain to Paul Bright saying, Beck jumped over, Jack jumping quick. Jack knocked over the candlestick, looking for meaning.
he jumped over the candlestick in his search for meaning?
Right. I really think that, you know, in his Jack, you know, sort of jumping the meaning, forgot about the existence of the candlestick.
I think that's just a tendency in all of us. I think it's increased now, this need to pigeonhole within the age of computerization and the ability to get all this information instantaneously. The beauty and the gamesmanship of actually the search seems to be thrown to the wayside when that's half the battle.
Well, you might agree, David, with that Wallace Stevens saying the greatest poverty is the absence of a physical world. I think that existences mustn't suffer at the expense of meaning. And it's so, you know, some people will look at my work and say, well, it's very sad, or are you hiding something, and so on. Or I think I see a woman there, but she's lonely, you know. And of course, I understand, as I think most people in the arts would understand, whether one is a musician or a graphologist, is that what people see usually is what they expect to see. And I think the education of an artist is essentially an education of educating one's attention to the thing that is, rather than looking at for the results that one intends. For instance, in a painting, one might say, you know, you'll get that, but there's a lot that was unintended, and one has to learn to attend to what is unintended but is also there. And that's where one finds, I think, the sense of propriety. As Picasso said, painting is not so much invention as it is a sense of propriety for the thing.
Yeah, you referenced that when you're in your work, in your painting, say, that you've got to keep in mind what the observer brings to the work as well. And I didn't get whether that was in creation or post-creation, that function of art. Could you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, I think it relates also to what James Joyce said about when the writer writes himself out of his writing, he has a novel. And my feeling is that I work at the extinction of my personality and bank or count on what I would call duration, that is, the contrast of duration. If one attends to a painting of mine, as I think with most painters, actually, whether it's a Rembrandt or a Titian or a Cezanne, something else will be disclosed. And, you know, very often what is disclosed permits one to see subtly and to think nobly. And that's not done by a wink of the eye.
Hmm.
So that, as I've thought about it for years and years, that the work can only, let's say, happen in the eye of the beholder if that eye is a sustaining one, a lasting one, that some things happen over time and not instantaneously.
This story has haunted me since I first heard it. It was probably over 20 years ago, but you just set me to thinking about this great master who had an apprentice and a young boy, and he was telling him about this beautiful portrait he was working on of a young woman, and he described it in great detail day after day, year after year, and eventually the young apprentice could stand it no longer, and he begged his teacher to show him this wonderful painting, and he eventually relented, and he went up to the studio pulled off the cover, and it was a blank canvas.
I think that was Myra Shapiro's favorite story. Maybe it was written by Balzac.
Balzac, that rings a bell.
Does that ring a bell with you?
It does. I can't remember the source. The story has stuck with me. I figured if anyone could know, maybe you would know. So you're thinking Balzac. Maybe that is true. It's a great image. I just love the story.
I think that if I recall correctly, though, what Prentice saw was just part of a foot. It wasn't completely blank.
Okay, I like that even better. Great. And it was wearing a Nike shoe, but that's another story. No, I'm just joking. Unbelievable. Talk a little bit about the relationship between your life in the studio, creating art, and then teaching.
Well, teaching for me was a way of enhancing my confidence in stray impulses.
Hmm.
I never really, for instance, taught art history in a straight line. I really believe that art is, diachronistic as it occurs across time. So that my comrades, Titian and Duccio and the cave painters and so on, it seems to me that there's a mode of action that we share, and I've participated in it. But I come to, in my painting, I come to understand that mode, differently. I think Norman Mailer said once, when somebody said, why are you writing another biography of Marilyn Monroe? There already have been written 12 of them, and he replied, because I want to understand her differently. And I think that that's really in the nature of art. That people may argue about what's beautiful. Well, in my opinion, what becomes beautiful is happens when the eye sees beautifully. And I think one can sort of tell when a person is just putting a stamp on what something should be, and when one really sees that alertness that one would call being visually enraptured, where they come to see something that they've seen for a long time, only they see something differently in it. Isn't that what Keats called negative capability, that you really can't exhaust a great work? At least an attentive eye can't exhaust, a great painting.
Or an attentive ear on a great piece of music.
Yes, right. why do they keep playing Puccini's operas or a Beethoven? My God. And of course, I agree with you, David, in every way. In all the arts, the great pieces of poetry, that one comes back to again and again and again, and it becomes even more moving, but more moving differently.
I was intrigued by a couple of your musical, I don't know if influences would be the right word, but a couple of composers of interest, including Morton Feldman and John Cage. But what do you admire most about their music, their contribution to the canon?
Well, I think that they introduced for me a syntax that I could translate visually. Hmm. And I remember my first year at Cooper Union, and I went to the Great Hall to hear, listen to a symposium where Morton Feldman was on it and Gage. And it just got into my head. I never heard anything like that. And I think it was the beginning of a vocabulary that I wanted to have. You know, for instance, you know, intervals in poetry, that not everything rhymes, but that meaning could sound meaning, and that maybe meaning was the sound. You know, it bound the world together for me at an age 19 when, you know, one tends to think of the world as falling apart.
There is a certain deliberateness to Morton Feldman's writing and the expansive time over which it takes that I find so unique. And I could see that as being kind of a touchstone for a young artist.
Do you know the story, and you stop me if you have, the one where Morton Feldman is very depressed and he goes to his teacher, former teacher at Columbia, and gives him a manuscript. And he said, "Would you please give me a criticism of this?" And so his mentor looks at it, and Morton Feldman is looking out the window. This is in New York, and looking out on 9th Avenue. And he said, "Well, the trouble, Mort, is that you've got to learn how to write from the man on the street." Hmm. And at that moment, Feldman looks down, and Jackson Pollock is walking across the avenue.
I am. You don't understand. That's exactly who I'm writing for. Oh, that's wonderful. That's a great story. I've never heard that before. I wonder whether this kind of convergence of all these rows and envelopes for you now in this exhibit, you're seeing a collection of these together. Do you look at them any differently through that lens, or is it just another collection of your work?
Well, actually, it's a very... insightful question, I think. As I wrote to Paul, because of this show, I have found that it is very difficult to address the envelopes as I once did, because it seemed to me that it had a kind of another, it had another motive to it. I mean, I never thought about finishing or showing these works. They were really sort of intimate, private delights, and sometimes delicious trouble that I sent along. But then it became, after this show was put together, it seemed to me that I was making something, whereas before it felt like I was realizing something. And, you know, the entelechy of the envelope. And so I stopped working the envelopes the way I did, because I thought I was simply making something, and sort of my ardor in making them had eroded that delight in understanding the address differently. You know, again, I didn't think of it as so much an invention or doing something new. I would use the Picasso term. I thought of finding what was proper to the thing, and it was difficult to send off an envelope, you might say, unadorned, without, sort of an image.
Hmm. You've referenced Picasso three or four times, and I'm beginning to think that he was one of the artists that's informed your work.
But I thought he had wit, and, I look at his work and I just shake my head, because it seemed to me that he was one who really understood that the secret is in the stray impulse. And one wonders, how did he think of that? And I think one of the ways he did that was he had less ardor for technique and was really a better judge of the event before him. So when I was artistically, I was born in the time of the abstract expressionists in 1952 and so on. And Franz Klein was one of my drawing instructors, and de Kooning came along as well. And so what they said is that, to me as instructors, is look for the event in the painting, And, of course, that made Titian or Lorrain or Chardin accessible. Forming is the fact of painting, I think, was their message. I remember Klein. Remember, I was 19, and he taught a drawing class at night. And we he came to my painting, and I thought I drew fairly well. I attended a technical high school for music and art in Detroit, Cass Tech. Anyway, he said, well, you know, you're concerned with finishing. I can see where you erased all of the lines and so on. He said, but your drawing is dead. Finishing is the death mask of art. And I said, well, I don't understand. He says, well, you know, you go from black to white or white to black, and so what? And I said, I don't understand, because one of the few things I knew was that Klein did work with black and white paint. And I said, I don't understand. And then he took the charcoal and he started drawing. And he said, well, you see, you're erasing the event of the drawing. And he said, the life of the marks constitute the life of the drawing. Hmm. If you look at an angle, you think of it as having an elegant line and so on, you'll see very often there are three or four lines that remain as he searches for the right angle of the proper contour of an arm. And I did. I would, you know, would look. But it was a great lesson. But I recall another instructor there who said to me, the problem for you is that you don't yet appreciate space. Of course, the abstract expressionists were known as space cadets, but I did listen to him, and he had this book on Rembrandt painting, and he said, look at that painting. He said, what makes it so remarkable to you? He said, well, you can look right into the painting, I mean, the depth of it. And he said, what are you looking into? And I said, well, shadow. And how does the shadow, is the shadow only on the shoulder, only on the arm? And I, you know, and I think I replied. I said, well, he's sort of enshrouded by this darkness or this lesser light. And he said, well, Rembrandt learned how to paint the space in front of space. And that's your problem. That's your task. That had stayed with me. Every painting, every drawing I made, you know, rather than sort of, you know, just plopping an image on top in outline or modeling and so on, so, you know, and then modeling it so it sort of pops off the page, and really try to make the page the equivalent of what the darker light or the lesser light was to a Rembrandt, that let it live in the white of the space. And let that white interrupt some of the marks that you, the one that I would put on the page, so that the image seems to be tucked into and enwrapped by the surface, rather than simply being on top of it. It was a really great lesson, and there's so many ways of approaching it.
There seems like there are two contradictory elements. You were talking about the looking for the event, and then also you're looking for the use of space in front of space, and yet the two complement each other. In that case, the thing that jumped out at you was really embracing of both.
That's right. I really call it my wire line when I'm drawing a line. You know, when you look at the wire, it seems like one is going over and the other is under, and then what is under becomes over and so on.
Sure.
But if you allow the white, or whatever is the value of the paper that one is drawing on, or the canvas, if you interrupt, let's say, the horizontal line by just a, you know, a sliver of white, then what gets interrupted is weakened, and the one that is uninterrupted, meaning the vertical line, is stronger and then appears to come over. And I would ask students, as I ask myself, what's getting interrupted? And I said, you know, they would say, well, the line is interrupted, this horizontal line is interrupted. And I would say, by what? And he'd say, well, by the vertical line. I said, now look closely And of course, what they discovered by looking closely, as I did, was that it was really the white of the paper that interrupted it. And in a sense, then, the white becomes stronger than the mark one puts on it. You know, it's sort of using all of the elements and components that one has at his or her disposal in painting, so that even the whole idea of less is more. Well, if you can use the paper as a forming element, as Clay said, forming is far more important than form. You are using an element that's already there, but it has been overlooked or underlooked.
Seems like that's always at the forefront of watercolorists. They're always preserving the white and painting around, redracting like a woodcutter.
Well, that's true. They really, and again, those whites are so delicious. And I remember as a 16-year-old loving the watercolors of Dong Kingman, but also David Stone Martin, who did a number of Columbia record labels, album covers. But delicious whites. I mean, they're just glistering, I would say.
Delicious whites. That's great. I'm taking that one. That's great. Yeah, likening the delicious whites to made me think of earlier when you're talking about that of something Miles Davis said, where he was just singing the praises for the rests. You know, the quiet in the song. And I mean, I can see a musical connection there as well.
Well, it's sort of homage. I think from time to time that core of silence is for those who are now still, and that may be my leaping to a meaning, but it is a feeling. And though I've been verbose in this interview, I do have that respect for restrained energies.